I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. Get more with Geico.
Pod, I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome to another Empire Podcast interview special, you lucky, lucky people. Hans Zimmer is one of our favorite composers around these parts, and he is the star and subject of a brand new concert film called Hans Zimmer and Friends, Diamond in the Desert, which is released in cinemas around the UK starting from Wednesday, March 19th. It's partly a concert film, bringing you performances from Hans' recent tour when he rocked up to Dubai with this incredible band and delivered versions of your favourite Zimmer tracks, Gladiator, Pirates of the Caribbean, Man of Steel, the Wonder Woman theme, and many, many more that go all the way up to 11. Believe me, watching Hans Zimmer rock out is quite the experience. But there are also bespoke performances in the Dubai desert which are visually stunning and brought to life by director Paul Dugdale. And if that weren't enough, Hans also tries his hand at interviewing, speaking to an incredible selection of people he's worked with over the years, including Chris Nolan, Denis Villeneuve, Pharrell Williams, Zendaya, Billie Eilish, Johnny Marr, Timothée Chalamet, Timmy Two Meats himself, and many, many more again throughout. So it's a concert film like no other, really, and if you're a Hans Zimmer fan, I can highly recommend it. I was delighted to be able to catch up with Hans Zimmer and director Paul Dugdale on Zoom recently. You're about to hear that conversation. Now, Hans was talking to us from his LA studio where he's currently hard at work on the score for F1. And for some reason, his voice, maybe he was a bit further away from the microphone, I don't know. But anyway, his voice was a little quieter than Paul's and mine. But hopefully, I've managed to boost his levels so you can hear what he has to say, because it is always worth listening to. So here you go, folks. The great Hans Zimmer and director Paul Dugdale. Enjoy.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
No, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at Geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
So when is a concert documentary not a concert documentary? When it is Hans Zimmer and Friends, Diamond in the Desert. And I'm joined by the great Hans Zimmer and the film's director, Paul Dugdale. Welcome to the Empire Podcast, guys.
Thanks for having us, Chris.
Yeah. Could be worse.
Hans, you've started off, you've gone in hot with you have fairly low expectations of what this podcast is going to be. That's good. Where are you both at the moment? Hans, you're in some incredible looking place.
I'm in LA. I'm in my studio. I'm in my studio, and I don't know where Paul is.
I'm in a study. I'm down near Brighton, so I'm back in the UK, and yeah.
Hans, that is a sumptuous studio. Is this where the magic happens?
This is where the magic happens, and this is where many tears are. You know, it's not just magic, you know, it's like hard work, sweat and toil and all that sort of stuff.
Well, there's a really fascinating interview, because I'll set this up obviously in the intro to this interview, but for people who haven't yet seen the film, it is not just a concert film. It is a film in which you explore what it is to be an artist. And there's a fascinating conversation with Denis Villeneuve where you talk about failure and how often Beethoven had to have failed before he wrote his Ninth Symphony. And is that something that you can both relate to, that, you know, failure is a pivotal, some would say necessary step along the road to success?
Absolutely. I mean, I have a tape somewhere that has 48 main themes for The Lion King. And that the 48 main themes are all, they're not bad. They're just not very good. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So they were like, close, but no cigar. But each one of those, each bit of failure brought me closer to, you know, to what I wanted to do. And there's something fabulous about failure, which is, you know, with films, when I fail, I mean, okay, forget the studio, that is going to be out of pocket. But I love failure because nobody's heard it. Nobody's seen it. So I still have a sort of a blank sheet. And I actually, if I really want to, I can go and lie about the whole thing. You didn't see my film? Oh, it was fabulous, you know? Knowing that they will never go and see it. So, you know, that works too.
And were the failures along the way towards this film, Paul?
I mean, I think it's good to kind of feel a bit of a struggle and fly close to the wind in terms of being very ambitious and trying to get things across the line that are a real annoyance to everybody and very difficult to achieve. I think this, you know, as you sort of mentioned, the film kind of straddles a lot of different environments and places and people, and so there were some challenges at times, but if you're not struggling or failing along the way, then you're probably not pushing hard enough, and ambition was kind of number one was very much on our conscience when we were making this film.
What were those ambitions when you first sat down and discussed doing this? Because Hans, you were already on the road, so you've been touring.
I think his ambition really was to actually get somebody other than Hans Zimmer to play the role of Hans Zimmer. You know, get Brad Pitt, whatever you do. You know, I think that's where it started.
That was, yeah. Harrison Ford wasn't available, but we settled with you, Hans, and I think you did a pretty good job of playing yourself.
And you really wanted the John Williams music. I know.
Harrison Ford is Hans Zimmer in a John Williams scored movie.
Absolutely. So basically, it all went wrong. It went terribly, terribly wrong. And what you saw is what you know, Paul ended up with. You know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really lucky to film a lot of enormous shows, rock shows, pop shows, classical shows, and this concert this sort of world that Hans has built on this tour is just a real spectacle and is an amazing experience, really. It's not just going to listen to music, you really feel it. And so it's my job, a bit like Hans, you know, when he's scoring, to try and make that feel, make it land even harder, you know, and try and accentuate that emotion. And that's really was the sort of main aim ambition from the sort of concert coverage point of view, was to just to do our best to kind of enhance the emotion of the music and make your heartbeat faster, you know.
I made absolutely sure that every day, every minute, I would mention to Paul that I've probably done quite a few more movies than he has ever done. So, you know, I just kept him, you know, kept him a little humble.
Yeah, but Hans, traditionally speaking, you're in the either in your studio or you're in Abbey Road or somewhere cool, but you're behind the scenes. But here you're front and center. You're right there in front of the camera. Was that different for you?
Well, you saw the film. You know whose fault it is. You know that it's Johnny Marr and Pharrell Williams who dragged me out, gave me reasons that I couldn't argue with. And you know that I had to look an audience in the eye eventually, and couldn't hide behind a screen for the rest of my life. And I said, "Well, what if I have incredible stage fright and probably going to throw up everywhere?" They just said, "That's the fun of it. That's the part of it." You know, I like it a little too much, as Johnny likes to point out.
You seem so natural up there, Hans. I always thought that you just seem so comfortable. I know you talk about it not being like that at the start, but it is amazing how natural it all seems to you.
Listen, all I do is I imagine, I get Haley, our lighting designer, to turn the lights on the audience after we play the first thing, and I have to speak to them. So I can see them, and I can see just enough of them to imagine it's just a dinner party, and we're just going to have a chat, right? So that calms things down, you know? It's not, oh my God, there are all these people here, you know? You know, what if I say the wrong thing? And you know something? I say the wrong thing all the time because I never prepare anything that I say. You know, hello, Oslo and Stockholm, and it just goes downhill from there. You know, I talk for ages about Gladiator and this and that and the other until somebody in my inner goes, we're not playing Gladiator now. Oh, you know. So there's a Python-esque, well, actually, it's probably more a Fawlty Towers sort of... you know, Basil Fawlty of stagecraft.
Oh my God! Well, there's worse things to aspire to than.
Well, it gives Paul sleepless nights and, you know, a lot of work to do.
I remember a conversation we had about you, about whether we should sort of start to sculpt some of those chats, and it was very quickly like, no, we will not be doing that. but that's the best thing, that they're so spontaneous and. You know, I think your character obviously is incredible in those moments, and the audience love it too. You know, can tell.
But sometimes when we did the interviews, and I can't remember which ones, you would sort of interfere by reminding us that we hadn't talked about any of the things which we were supposed to be talking about.
Right.
You know, so we'd have to like do the thing again, you know, look spontaneous and actually talk about the stuff that was supposed to be talked about.
Well, that's one of the things that really sets this film apart as well. I mean, you have these incredible locations, you have these incredible concerts that you're pulling the musical performances from, but then you also have musical performances in bespoke settings, which are fantastic. But I think the icing on the cake are the interviews. Hans, you're a polymath. Not only are you a composer, but you're a great interviewer as well.
I don't know. That was entirely and absolutely Paul's fault. idea, I mean, creation, genius. I had my doubts at first, and then we was it me who wanted to shoot them, like, in black and white and square, or was it you? I can't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember, but we definitely both like that, yeah.
Yeah, we liked that a lot, you know? So I don't know, you know? I mean, I think one of the things that Paul and I actually really like is playing with style, you know? Just keeping it going on many, you know, letting surprises happen, you know? Where is he? Oh, God. It's he and his little, poor little piano on top of this crazy building, you know? And what's going on? You know, everybody was going, a terrible accident will happen, you know? I mean, but we braved the heights and, you know, I mean, so it is spectacular, you know? The chosen locations are really spectacular, you know? And I love, my favorite bit, of course, is Interstellar, which I had absolutely nothing to do with other than the notes. And it was an entirely Paul's creation, you know? And I just love that he did that, you know? That, I mean, only a madman would do that.
Paul, have you played?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it's that is a really special piece. And, yeah, I should sort of big up the team at North House who made the bespoke projections for that. So for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's like a enormous dome which has 360-degree projectionable surface on it. And so we created bespoke visuals to go with the music, and the band are in the center on a very small-looking stage, although it is a very big stage, actually, but it looked tiny in relation to the building. So there's an incredible performance happening, but it is accompanied by these spectacular visuals that are very well kind of thought out and curated and timed to go with the music. And that was a really special one. Again, hard to pull off, hard to get in there. The logistics of it all that boring stuff was all quite tough. But an incredible looking and sounding piece.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrific. And I wanted to talk to you guys about curating a set list almost. So Hans, how you approach putting a set list together as a musician / late blooming rock god. And Paul, did you approach this movie in a way as a set list as well in terms of the interviews? Knowing, you know, you start off with Johnny Marr. I'm not going to reveal who you end with, but you have Denis Villeneuve, you have Chris Nolan, you have, you know, Timothy Chalamet, Zendaya, you have all these incredible people, Billie Eilish and Phineas, all these incredible people. So did you, both of you, how you approached seeding all that stuff, Hans musically?
Well, my set list, the original set list was 6 hours long. And I didn't know how to cut it down, so I just threw it like to the wolves, which is basically the band, and said, what do you want to play? So we voted on things. I mean, it was pretty haphazard. You know, like, I didn't want to play Lion King, and Niall Marr, Johnny Marr's son, is going, Hans, get over yourself. That's the music of my youth. We got to do that. And I'm going, I think this will not work. And we played, I mean, a few years ago, we played Coachella, you know, the festival in the desert here in California. And we're playing Lion King, and I'm going, this is not going to work. And I look out, and 80,000 grown-ups are crying their eyes out. And I'm going, maybe it does work, you know? So they're guilty pleasures. They're films that failed. Did we take anything out of the film?
Yes, more for time than anything else, to be honest. Yeah. But we took out The Last Samurai, James Bond, and Top Gun. But purely because we were running so long, and it was very tough to get it to a time that we felt was watchable. And I'm sure that those pieces will find the light of day at some point, and they are astonishing performances. I mean, from my point of view with that, the it's kind of slight chicken and egg in that we knew roughly where some of the positioning of those people would be, because we knew that it would help tell the story of the songs around them. And really, of course, they are incredible talent and artists in that, but we wanted to use them in order to make the music either side land harder, really. And so you get a little bit of context to these pieces, stories. And as Hans touched on, a lot of the time I would have an idea of what I wanted them to talk about, but we always started those conversations just completely letting Hans and whoever it was just go. Like, they didn't really, it was just a pure conversation, and we really wanted them to feel informal, because the performances are so precise and electric and huge, big scale, and we wanted the interviews to feel a much more kind of just kind of much more intimate and informal, and kind of have this very sort of basic nature where you're just purely listening to what they're talking about, rather than trying to do anything too bombastic. So that's kind of how we steered them. And sometimes there are a couple of occasions where, for example, Zendaya talks about loving Interstellar and what it means to her. And then also Hans and her talked about Lion King and what it meant to her, but she brought it up and brought out an amazing anecdote from Hans. And so it really worked like that. Hans was kind of interviewing them, but actually they were asking questions back, and it was a real to and fro, and it sort of enabled us to have a real 3D portrait of Hans, you know, and as well as the Hans's collaborators, learning about them. But we learned a lot about him in that process, and that was kind of the purpose of the device, was to find out more about him too.
I actually wanted to talk about, with Timothée, I actually wanted to talk about Interstellar, because that's where I first met him. He was the little boy in Interstellar,
yeah.
And not talk to him about Dune, but sort of or do both, you know? I mean, part of the idea was it was about people who knew me well and who I had maybe not worked so much, but been friends with, you know, and they knew all the war stories, you know. which of course makes it dangerous because they really do know all the where everything is hidden. So, but that's good. I mean, Jerry Bruckheimer. You know, we could do a 2-hour film about Jerry and me. You know, just about the fights we had, just about the experiments I've thrown at him that he absolutely would reject, and then we would come back to them and we would sort of win, and you know, all that stuff.
Because it was Days of Thunder the first time you worked with those guys, wasn't it, Jerry?
Yeah,
and Don?
Absolutely, Jerry and Don. Yeah, I thought if I could survive them, I can do anything. and they were. I mean, just the most respectful, wonderful people. Yeah.
Does it get easier working with Jerry over the years?
He just defends what I do, you know, which is sort of, yeah, you know, it's. I think it's not the years; it's the mileage. Since I'm back on a race car movie with him, but it's good to work with people who know you, know what you want to do, and go with you on that journey.
In terms of the interviews, you're a very good interviewer, as I said, Hans. I don't want to be put out of a job, quite frankly, but I would listen to a Hans Zimmer interviews. Famous People About Music podcast. I would absolutely do that, and so would at least three other people. So that's good. Yeah. But who was the biggest surprise for you? Because Timothy Chalamet was really learned about music, film music.
Timmy was the biggest surprise because he was so on. He's so smart and he's so on the case, and he knows so much about music, and especially about my music. So, yes, you know, I mean, you have to understand that the whole Dune thing is sort of slightly different because it really is a family. It really feels like a family with Denis, who is the most gentle dad you can possibly have. And all he does is he encourages you all the time, you know. Everybody brings everybody together all the time, so there's a lot of that going on, which is still a little bit odd. I mean, it's not atypical of films, but it's just more so with them, you know.
And Paul, in terms of the technical challenge of this, you shot in how many locations around the world?
Oh my god! Well, they were all in Dubai. I think there was 5 or 6 exteriors. And then around the world, we shot the interviews. They were in various places, some in New York, some in London. And the main concert was also in Dubai. But they were also done kind of over quite a broad amount of time because Hans was touring and, you know, had other things on. So it was it was kind of a blessing and a curse. We were desperate for the film to come out because we loved it. But the longer it went on, we'd suddenly go, oh, Hans, we've had an idea. Can you phone so-and-so? And suddenly they were in the film. And, you know, it kind of worked a little bit like that. And so I'm quite glad for the time in the end. It was an amazing...
I felt like, which I think was a late thought, Billy and Phineas was sort of a late thought. And I actually loved... I don't know what's in the film, and I don't know what was in my head from the conversations. When she talked about that, when we worked together, she was just 17. I didn't really know how any of this worked, you know. And I remember her being so grown up. And there's a thing that I'm so dying to do. And in fact, I just asked her, "Can we do this?" That there was a moment when we were working on Bond where she was out in the studio and she was just tinkering on the piano, and I came out. I just sat down next to her wordlessly, and we just started sort of having this musical conversation for like an hour, and it was a great way to not take up time with needless words, but get incredibly, you know, close to a person, you know, just by, you know, questions and answers in music, you know, just by playing little phrases and making things.
I mean, that seems to be what you're doing with these shows. You're having incredible musical conversations. You know, when I watch you in this movie, I'm watching someone who is just in the grip of pure joy. There's a moment where Guthrie, your guitarist, one of your guitarists, who you call the world's greatest guitarist, does this absolute face melter. I mean, it's an amazing solo. I'm just doing a little bit of air guitar now. Yeah. and you are going across to him and just looking at him in awe. And it's just joy.
Well, it's just not that. I mean, I have a choice here. I can just play along and play the chords, you know, and that's really boring. And nobody needs my chords at that point because it's all about Guthrie. Or I can get really close to him and just really enjoy watching the creative process unfold. Because what he's done, we now have done 207 shows, and he always plays something completely fresh. He never repeats. So that's a pretty amazing brain in there.
Amazing. And you said to me at that time, Hans, that you said, when he plays the solo, I'm going to go over, but I always put my hands in my pockets because I don't want people to look at me or think I'm about to do something or play something. I love that. And when we put it in the film, we just hold it as a one shot. It's just, we don't cut. We just let him play and just watch it. And so there's no, you know, that is literally as he did it. And you just get to watch it in one go, in one hit. It's pretty amazing, yeah.
I mean, he truly is a phenomenon. I'll tell you a story. We played Brussels, we played Belgium, and I was invited for tea by His Majesty, the King of the King of the Belgians. And he said, would it be okay if he and his family came to the show that night? Absolutely. And show ends, I'm in my dressing room, and usually my dressing room is empty, but the king is there, and so therefore the whole band is in there, right? And he goes, there's one person missing. And I know it's Guthrie, and he's out there scoring a beer, you know, because that's more important. He doesn't care about kings and queens, you know. He cares about a good Belgian beer. So somebody finds Guthrie, and you do, it's very formal, the king. I mean, you do address him as Your Majesty, which I don't think Guthrie quite does. He does, you know, he slithers past whatever the introduction is. And then the king sort of puts his arms around his shoulders and walks him a little out of earshot, but not out of my earshot. And he says, I have a dream that one day, just for one day, I can be you. As you know, wow. It was great. You know, I mean,
that's extraordinary.
Guthrie will destroy empires and, you know, royal houses with his playing.
That's amazing. Belgian royalty say that to me all the time. I wish I could be you just for one day. I've got to let both of you go now, but Hans, we've had you on the Empire podcast a couple of times before, and one of my favorite Hans Zimmer compositions over the years, we've mentioned this to you in the past, is Going for Gold.
Absolutely. It is an undeniable masterpiece.
It is an undeniable masterpiece. I still know the lyrics to this day. Did you write the lyrics for that?
No, my friend Sandy McClellan wrote the lyrics for that. He was a recording engineer, and he sings it. I was on it at Paul the whole time, like a small yapping dog, saying, "We got to do Going for Gold." I don't know. Somehow he didn't.
Well, it did come up in conversation with Denny and Tanya, and that was really funny. And you were swearing at me down the. I don't know what made me, because we did. I did bring it up with them, and we talked about it a bit. Maybe that footage will at some point see the light of day. It's very funny.
You see it. There it is.
Denny Villeneuve trying to get his head round Going for Gold is quite something.
You did a game show?
It's not just a game show, Lee game show. And that theme tune is incredible. And honestly, if you burst into Going for Gold on stage, the crowd would go apeshit.
I think they would. I think next time we do London, we have to do it.
You have to do it. The heat is on. The time is right.
But remember, it's pan-European. You know, right now, in the times we are in, where Trump is basically throwing Europe into the garbage, and you know, and I think we could make this the new European anthem.
I agree. You know? I agree.
Actually, going back to the movie, you know what is important?
Yeah.
Is the orchestra is from Ukraine.
Oh.
The orchestra's from Ukraine, and we worked with them quite a few times before the war started. And then when the war started, it was very difficult to get them out. And it became impossible for them to actually go back. So this sort of remarkable thing happened where the German government, with like no bureaucracy and paperwork and any of that bullshit, they have these holiday villages, you know, up in the Alps, you know. I mean, and they just gave them a holiday village to live in. So that's where they live now. You know, the 3 hours that we play, they can't get at their cell phone. So they don't know if the house has been bombed and if mother is alive or not. I mean, that's a real life scenario. So there is always, you know, there's always real life is in every show. You know, the tragedies and the joys. You know, I don't know if you can tell that one of my violinists is how many months pregnant was she?
She was 7 or 8 months. Yeah, it was.
Wow.
Yeah. And Paul shot around her belly very carefully.
It's an amazing show and an amazing film. Guys, I'm going to let you go. Hans, I presume you're working on F1 right now. I wouldn't want to get in the way of that.
No, you wouldn't.
Okay.
They'll run you right now.
Are you failing or are you succeeding right now?
Oh, succeeding big time. You know, audiences in previews love the music. So I'll take that for now.
Take that for now, indeed. Brilliant. And Paul, are you failing or succeeding right now on what are you working on?
Good. Yeah, I'm working on a couple of big rock shows, the big heavy rock shows at the moment, a couple of big stadium things that will come out later in the year. Yeah.
Oh, he's not going to tell us what.
No.
No, I'm not allowed.
Of course not. Of course not. But yeah. I gave it a good go. Brilliant. Paul, Hans, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks so much indeed for your time.
Brilliant.
Thank you. Yes.
Okay, that was Hans Zimmer and Paul Dugdale. And you heard it, folks. You heard Hans Zimmer promise UK audiences going for gold. And I'm pretty sure that's legally binding. As I said earlier on, Hans Zimmer and Friends Diamond in the Desert is out for Wednesday, March 19th, in cinemas across the UK. To find out if it's screening near you, check out HansZimmerFilm.com. HansZimmerFilm.com. Okay, that's enough for me. I'm off to learn to play guitar like Guthrie Govan and impress the hell out of the Belgian royal family. Thanks for listening. See you next time. Bye-bye.